Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will talk about the need for an innovative industrial policy in Europe to achieve net zero, growth and resilience. Joining me from our Bruegel team today are our senior fellows Simone Tagliapietra and Reynil De Veugelers, whom have edited a volume about the topic and which has been recently published by us. You will find the link in the show notes. Hi, Simone and Renilde. How are you?
Hello. All good.
I'm as good as a concerned citizen can be.
I also have the honor to host Philippe Aguillon, who is professor of economics at the London School of Economics and at the Collège de France. Philippe has been one of the contributors to the book that I was just mentioning before, and he has written one of the chapters. Philippe, officially welcome you to The Sound of Economics.
Hi, thanks for being there with you.
The discussions about China's rise as a global economic power and the challenges it brings are similar to how European governments felt uneasy about the United States and Japan's technological leadership in the 1970s and the 1980s. Today, old questions about industrial policy are resurfacing, but they are more complicated now because we urgently need to address global warming. In a world affected by climate change, there is a difficult choice to make between three competing priorities: strategic autonomy, economic efficiency, and global decarbonization. At the core of this choice is whether European governments are willing to prioritize geopolitical resilience over economic efficiency. This dilemma, or rather this trilemma, leads to other important questions. Who should bear the cost of ensuring security? How can we minimize this cost by promoting technological innovation to replace critical resources instead of investing in expensive domestic mining projects? How can we turn this situation into an opportunity to create good jobs and speed up the process of decarbonization? And so forth. Renilde, Simone, You've tried to condense all these questions and much more related issues in the book. Can you guide us through to give us a key to interpret those major challenges?
Thank you, Giuseppe. And indeed, Renilde and I started this project last year with an aim of really doing an exercise that could be long-lasting. So we didn't at the time, no, we were still in the middle of the energy crisis. So this was seen as a sort of long-term problem for Europe. Now, this year, namely after the adoption of the Inflation Reduction Act, the industrial policy discussion in Europe significantly revived, and now we see the Net Zero Industry Act, the Critical Raw Materials Act, and all of that. But when we had this in mind, we didn't have this pressure that we have today on this topic in Europe. And under this perspective, we feel lucky of having this book now, because this book is really a book that brings together among the best scholars in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere in the world on industrial policy. And really, with these contributions to the book, these scholars, these professors of economics, industrial policy, have been trying to address some of the important questions that you mentioned at the beginning. If you look at the debate around industrial policy, which is basically a debate on the role of state in the economy, I think you can track back in history different cycles. So before and during the Second World War, industrial policy in Europe was, of course, extremely interventionist. That was still the case in the 60s, in the 70s. Then in the 80s, we had a phase of liberalization that continued in the 90s and in the early 2000s. And then something started to change after the great financial crisis. And of course, with the pandemic on the one hand and the war in Ukraine on the other, there has been a strong comeback of industrial policy, which is really, at the end of the day, putting forward this big question about how do we calibrate between economic efficiency and comparative advantage, sort of modus operandi we always had in the past years, and strategic autonomy / geopolitical resilience. This is the key question of de-risking that now is, of course, driving the agenda in Europe and elsewhere. And I think that our contributors to the book show a certain consensus on the legitimacy and the significance of revitalizing industrial policy. So the question is not whether or not we should have an industrial policy. I think that more or less there is an agreement that we should have an industrial policy. The question is how to design these industrial policy. And here I think there is also an agreement, a sort of consensus, at least among our contributors to the book, that industrial policy should be a mix of instruments, both supply and demand side, such as, for example, supports to innovation, technology adoption, regulatory frameworks, and of course, carbon pricing and other framework conditions. In a way, what we see is a view of industrial policy that starts unavoidably with innovation, but doesn't stop with innovation, because there is this idea that Europe cannot be the incubator of the world. It is important for Europe not only to be innovative, but also to have a market for these green innovative products and be able to manufacture these technologies also in the continent. And in order to do that, a mix of instruments, stick and carrots, are necessary to move things forward. But I'm sure that Renilde can elaborate on this as well.
Yeah, thanks, Giuseppe. Indeed, the question is really how to design that new industrial policy perspective, taking into account this multidimensionality of objectives that we're facing here. So a mix of instruments is very, very important. Also public-private partnerships, including also civil society, because we really want to take the take-up of these new technologies on board. And also taking a look at the mix of policy instruments as a portfolio where you take into account already existing technologies, but also new technologies, and be willing to take risk on also new technologies that are still in the pipeline here and need to be further developed. Overall, this mixing of instruments, this balancing between instruments, bottom up, top down, across different policy areas here, makes it perhaps the biggest challenge for industrial policy, the governance of all this. Being able to really manage and coordinate among all the different instruments, among the different players here, including at the state level, at the global level, at the regional level here. That's for me, I think, one of the biggest challenges. And the fact that that's so critical is that policymakers really have to have an interest in taking a longer term perspective and having also the capacity to be able to manage that systemic policy approach that's needed.
Thank you, Renilde, for this. And speaking about the policymakers, I turn to Philippe, because in your contribution to the book, you basically agree to what Simone just said, that industrial policy is essential for the competitiveness of the EU industry. Basically, there is a need for a new industrial policy. And you try to disentangle what Renilde was just mentioning before about the role of policymakers, but also the redesign of governance of industrial policy to make it more compatible with this competition and innovation-led growth tenet. What do you propose in this regard in your chapter?
I mean, exactly what you said, I mean, and what Renilde said, and we have to reconcile industrial policy and competition. First, I mean, it's true that we can do a lot, one can achieve a lot with horizontal policies, which are not just education, innovation policy broadly, the fiscal and regulatory environment. All those things are paramount. You can have any industrial policy you want. If you don't have, a good environment in terms of education, competition policy, regulation and taxation, you won't get anywhere. So that, I think, is number one. Industrial policy is not at all something which is supposed to substitute to good, well-designed horizontal policy. But then it's true there are some areas where you have coordination problems, where you have the S-curve problem. You want to achieve a certain goal, some climate innovation or the vaccines or the defense and space. And there you are in the DARPA, what I call the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, which was created in the US in the 50s. They had to put a man in space within a year or two. They had to achieve some goals. They were racing with the Soviet Union, and they had to coordinate resources. It was very important to have a mechanism to coordinate resources. And they invented the DARPA, where the money comes from the ministry. Then they have team leaders, but they have a clear to elicit competing projects. So it's a mixture of top-down and bottom-up, but with a mission. The other example was BARDA, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, thanks to which we are all here now, which turned RNA messenger technology into mass production of vaccines within a year. And for that, you needed government intervention. And it was, again, smart industrial policy because the initiative came from the top, but they elicited competing labs to propose vaccines. And that's the kind of industrial policy I have in mind. That means something where you are facing a coordination problem, an S-curve problem. Basic research has been done, but you have not turned it to operational applications. And you need to coordinate actors and resources to do that. And there, the state has a role to play, or governments have a role to play. Or it can be one country, or it can be a set of European countries who achieve this goal. And obviously, on health, or on defense, and on energy, those are areas very natural for DARPAs. That's why I think would be interesting. So it's important to have this modern view of industrial policy. And on the competition side, I think in Europe, we've been too much obsessed by market share and market definition, not enough about whether or not a merger and acquisition can be detrimental, future innovation and future entry. We have not factored in innovation and entry enough in our way of doing competition policy. In the name of competition policy in particular, we precluded any form of sectoral state aid. I think we should not. We should allow for sectoral state aid, but then ex post check that competition is preserved. So we need to reform competition policy to make it more pro-entry, pro-innovation. At the same time, we need to reform our thinking of industrial policy to make it more competition-friendly. And if we manage to do both, then you can have competition policy and industrial policy, you know, moving hand in hand. And that's what I have in mind.
Philip, you point out exactly my next question, because safeguarding competition and at the same time enabling the entry, the new firms and so on, but at the same time coexist this with these structural changes and dynamics that you need to enact in order to ensure that there is a push also and a support for this innovation to be scaled up. How exactly can be possible, I mean, reconciling these two dynamics? And I'm getting back to Simone and Renilde if they want to comment on your last reflection on this aspect.
Yeah, I very much agree with what Philip said. And of course, one of the key challenges of governments here is to define a right balancing act between the kind of horizontal policies we need to have in place to ensure an enabling framework conditions for private investments, namely in the different sectors that we are now increasingly naming as strategic, and more vertical policies to provide more specific support where needed. Now, on this question about where to provide the specific support, I think it's very important to focus on externalities, and it's very important to define areas of intervention where the public sector really has an additionality, and always bearing in mind that ultimately what the public sector need to do here is to enable the private action. Because if you think, for example, at the green transition, but also at the digital revolution and so on, it's clear that only the private sector has the capacity to make the investments that are required in these historical challenges. And the role of governments should be to enable these private investments. And here, I think one of the most fascinating questions is about striking the right balance between openness and, let's say, interventionism, right? Which should not lead to protectionism, because otherwise we risk to compromise our other societal goals, such as, for example, the speed of decarbonization.
And on this, I will come back in a second, but on what we just discussed, I would like to push Renilde a little bit, because one aspect that I don't find too much into the discussion, or like not as much as I would like to, especially at the European level, is, for instance, what would be the role of capital markets union and completing the capital markets union as part of this conversation on industrial policy as well. It seems that this is a little bit the part that is left behind. We speak a lot about subsidies. We speak a lot about different measures that needs to be done. But I don't hear that much push in certain quarters for capital markets unions. What do you think, Renilde?
Yeah, I think that's really very good point, because access to finance is one of the important dimensions that's also needed to have private investment enough incentivated here. And we do know that in Europe, the fact that we don't have a large integrated market, financial market, where it's at lower financial cost possible for companies to access finance, that's definitely something that we need to work on. The only thing is we've been working on that for a long time here, and we can keep on repeating that. But the question is, how much can we speed it up, actually? Another important dimension, I think, which is also too much neglected in the whole discussion, is access to the right technical skills for companies to be able to implement these new technologies here. Access to skills is also something that's very often mentioned, but not much happening in terms of policy actions, really at a large integrated European market. So that's for me also, and that's why in general also thinking more of using the EU scale to really offer the kind of framework conditions that companies need, that's very important. And at the same time, an EU scale that's also sufficiently international open here, because access to finance, access to skills, access to know-how, that really plays at a global level.
Yeah, thank you. And Philip, another aspect which I think it's, related to all this is that on the other hand, there is a lot of talk on the need for de-risking and talk on the concept of economic security on this space. And especially de-risking as a term has been used for the first time by the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, regarding the strategy of the EU towards China, and has been picked up both by the US Presidential Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, as well in the official documents of the G7 in Japan earlier this spring. How do you see reconciling this de-risking strategy that needs to be put forward towards the challenges of the geopolitics involved in all this, and this efficiency and innovation drive which needs to be kept in the circle?
Yeah, so I think first, in terms of geopolitics, it's true. The problem is that the US, they do a lot of industrial policy. China does. And Europe has had the problem of being what I call a regulatory giant and a budgetary dwarf. And in particular, the combination of the Maastricht Treaty of a competition policy, integration policy, which is very much against any kind of sectoral state aid, and a very small EU budget, which is just 1% of GDP of Europe. And the fact that very timid policy of borrowing as EU has limited EU's ability to compete with the US and China. I am not in favor of doing away with Maastricht Treaty and competition policy. I think those are good, but I think we need to reinterpret them. For example, investment which are pro-environment and pro-growth should not be counted in the same way as recurrent spending. That's for the Maastricht Treaty. On competition policy, we should have an ex-post approach, not an ex-ante approach. We should not a priori preclude sectoral state aid. We should look whether the aid was pro or anti-competition ex post. And then we should allow for more EU borrowing. There was some EU borrowing during COVID. I think, for example, for the environment, I am in favor of using the proceeds from carbon tax and the ETS as a backup for increasing EU borrowing aimed at projects on green. And the idea would be that that would be some funds. And then you do some development banking like EBRD. You see what I mean? Use those funds, and they maybe the EIB could do part, I don't know. And those funds then would be co-invested with private sector. So then based on those funds, you would have a multiplier effect with private sector to invest in green projects. And I think that that's something where really we can do much better in Europe than we are. We have to be more inventive. And so that's what I hope. I hope that we could have more EU borrowing backed by the carbon tax and ETS proceeds and use that to, with the private sector, exactly, the railway in France, the railway system was built by a partnership between state and private companies. We can do something similar for green. And that's why we can mobilize the capital market sector with these funds, this EU fund, and very much with a kind of DARPA type of governance. And I think there we can do really something novel. And vis-à-vis China, I think we have to be vigilant vis-à-vis China. We have to diversify our imports. We should not be dependent on China. But I am not in favor of emulating Trump-Biden policy vis-à-vis China. They have their policy. We don't have no reason why we should exactly do like what they do vis-à-vis China. And that's it. We have to be vigilant vis-à-vis China, of course. Make sure that they abide by the WTO rules. We have to not depend on China. But for example, the kind of thing like China initiative, where the US decided to restrict collaborations between US and Chinese researchers, I don't think Europe should do the same kind of thing. Maybe in some defense-related things, but I think we should not go down that road. It's a kind of co-petition. We compete, but there are areas of cooperation. And I think we have to manage smartly the relationship with China. We should not imitate exactly the US policy vis-à-vis China.
I see Renilde nodding at you, Philippe. So perhaps you would like to add something on that point.
Yeah, I fully agree that we should use the EU level also more to provide the funding from the ETS revenues or from borrowing. That's exactly also what the sovereignty fund that's been announced has in petto. I find it a pity that this was not tied to the Net Zero Industry Act here, because these two really are intrinsically linked. And I think it's also really a matter of trying to come up with good suggestions of what to do with these funds and what to do at the EU level that really complements and subsidiarity with what can be better done at the national and the regional levels and international here. So it's on the one hand making sure we have a bigger pot of money ready, but also having a really good idea of what we can do with these instruments. And I fully agree, we might not know always exactly what the best instruments are. So that's why we should experiment more also, but then experiment so that we ex post very carefully monitor whether it works or not and adjust as soon as possible. And that includes also what we should do in terms of collaborating with the US and China in terms also of decoupling or not. I think we should be very careful there, still try to have that mix of cooperation, like you say, competition and cooperation here, but really carefully monitor whether this all works to the advantage of the multidimensional objectives that we have in terms of decarbonization, competitiveness and security of supply.
Simone, maybe also something from your side on those.
Yeah, I think what Philippe said could be summarized by saying the risking is good, the coupling is bad. And I would fully subscribe to that. I think that we have a number of cases that we can make to show, to illustrate the value of international collaborations that might be more or less actually planned. Take the example of solar panels. Solar panels are a success story. Today, producing electricity with solar panels is extremely competitive because we were able to slash the cost of this technology over the last years, thanks to a mix of possibly even unwanted collaboration between the US, when back already in the 60s, in the 70s, there was a lot of research into that. And then, of course, also in Europe, and then big subsidies in Europe for the deployment, and then massive manufacturing of this technology in China, overcapacity and all of that. So having international collaborations and keeping the doors open to that, it's very important. And I think this is another message that comes out of our book in several chapters very, very clearly. We should not fall into the temptation of closing our borders. But as Philippe said, one needs to monitor. And one needs to monitor that we are basically not the only ones in Europe playing by the rules of the game. And that is not, of course, something feasible. So it is very important to keep high the attention on that. And of course, reducing our vulnerabilities by de-risking is a sensible strategy, as the energy crisis illustrated last year in the case of gas. But from that to decoupling, there is a long way. And I fully subscribe to the idea that for Europe, decoupling from China is not only detrimental, but it will also be impossible if we look at the current situation we have in a number of technologies and critical raw materials.
Well, there is another aspect which concerns the speed of change and the speed of the transition, especially when it comes to net zero, which is the fact that we are racing against time. The speed of climate change is changing faster and faster, and there should be one common goal, which is transitioning as soon as possible. Given these challenges that you just mentioned and the geopolitics around it, isn't there a risk that the speed that we need to put into this transition might be affected?
Yeah, I think that if not properly designed, these industrial policies might risk to slow down the transition, of course. And that's why I go back to the point that it's very important to strike the right balance here between openness and domestic support and all of that. Try to reject self-sufficiency targets as much as possible and really try to go for a competitive strategy that strikes the right balance, basically, between competition policy and a more vertically driven industrial policy in certain sectors that are defining for our future.
And I'm looking at Philippe and Renilde now. Do you agree that it is actually possible to combine all these elements, the speed of the transition, the economic security and the innovation drive that is needed in order for this industrial policy to be successful and competitive globally? I go back to the trilemma that I was describing at the beginning, because we are going towards the end of this episode, and I think it would be good also for our listeners to wrap it up by rethinking about this triangle and how this triangle can go can go hand in hand together.
I have my own view. My own view is that you have to do as much as you can. Innovation, never deterministic. You increase the probability. You know, when we had AIDS, you had to find a medicine against AIDS. And at the end, we came up with three medicines. By investing massively, we increase the probability of soon getting there. It's never a deterministic process. But I think if you combine the carbon tax and ETS, which is a very, very important instrument, so absolutely you have to be, you know, sure that that's one pillar instrument, all what has to do with the price of carbon, all what has been done at European level to make progress in that direction is very important. But if we, on top of that, have good industrial policy green in Europe, focusing on key goals, would it be electric cars, hydrogen, nuclear fusion, maybe plan B, but it could be a kind of limited set of things. We cannot do zillions things, but we can say, well, you know, we believe that there are four or five main things. So we have the carbon tax, and on top of that, we put our eggs on four, five main things, and we go all full steam on that. And we see if it doesn't work, we can rearrange. But that would be my own take, to have the horizontal policy, which is to say, help carbon tax important. We know that in general, providing finance also by itself helps green innovation. Because I am doing some work now showing that the lack of finance and credit access prevents small firms from doing green innovation. So that's horizontal as well. And on top of that, you do vertical in some things, you know, the DARPA is a good thing because DARPA, you have a priority and then some people can come up with various projects to achieve certain kind of goals. And that I think would be reasonable to do. And we know hydrogen, batteries, the nuclear fusion, and possibly some plan B. One of the plan B is the sulfur thing of Harvard University. We may want to get into that. There is another plan B, which with mirror system that designed to cold the air, to cold up the atmosphere. They are not fully operational, but there are fast progress on those. Maybe we want to step in on this. We may not want to have the US to monopolize. I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe not. I'm not the one to decide. But there are at least, you see, some technologies, some, let's say, big roads, which we want to explore, and we should have the tools to explore them. On top of the horizontal policies, which I see as very fundamental. That's my own take, but Renil knows much better than I do.
Yeah, no, of course, I fully align with this empowering the innovation, really, to make sure that we get these objectives as soon as possible and the multidimensionality of these objectives. But what I'm a bit afraid of also is because we think we are really under time pressure, is that we need to go for the existing technologies here and trying to improve them as much as possible. But I think we also need to make sure that we, with these existing technologies and improving those existing technologies, we buy enough time so that we also have time for more drastic innovations that may help us to address this in the longer term here. And again, this will not come naturally. These other technologies here also, that needs to be part of an industrial policy that balances enough targeting versus horizontal conditions. So that's really taking that long-term perspective and again makes it so much important that we have a well-governed policy for climate change here that also takes a longer-term perspective.
Thank you so much. We could go for much longer, obviously, because the topic is immense, but this is all the time that we have for this episode. So I would like to remind our listeners that, as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars, as well as the blueprint edited by Renilde and Simone, with the contribution of Philippe and many other contributions on our website, www.bruegel.org. Philippe, Simone, Renilde, thanks a lot for joining this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Simone and Renilde have done a fantastic job. And Europe needs to wake up, because otherwise it will be China and the US. And Renilde and Simone are among those who understand that really well.
Thank you. And on this note that you're just saying that Europe has to wake up, I would like to thank also all our listeners. Until next time. Bye-bye.